Ladies and gentlemen, we have reached the appointed time and a little past it. We'll convene the meeting of the House Committee on Health Care for Friday, March 18, 2011. And as per usual, we will change the order of business as posted. We do that every time. It's not just in honor of you. I didn't want her to feel extremely special.
You had some points coming.
Right.
Stick with this.
Anyway, we're going to move into a public hearing on House Bill 2918, and I'm going to ask Representative Nolan to join us so we can get her out of here and on to something else that she can be doing.
Thank you, Mr.
Although we're very pleased to have her here.
We're extremely pleased to have her here. Yeah.
Extraordinarily pleased.
I just didn't want anybody to I didn't want anybody to be surprised we're changing the order of business like every time.
Mr. Chair, I think there's been a call for division of the House.
We're especially pleased that she's keeping you here on a Friday afternoon. Mr. Co-Chair, Messer's Co-Chair, I guess, and members of the committee, my name's Mary Nolan. I have the privilege of representing the good people of District 36 here in this House, and I wanted to thank you for a few moments to introduce House Bill 2918 to you. And more particularly, I want to focus on what motivated me to file this bill and to ask for your brief attention to it. I want to acknowledge that many of you are working. I don't know if everyone is working. All of you will eventually be working on the health exchange concept. And should that proceed as I understand it to develop?
I have one moment.
Yes, sir.
To interrupt you. I have screwed up. First time ever.
I'm sure it was my fault.
I believe I announced 2908 that we're hearing. We are hearing 2918.
Okay.
With that
That's
correction,
what I'm talking about.
Please continue.
I'm still
it wasn't your doing, it was
Mary
mine.
Nolan.
Okay.
Thank you. I came to the legislature from service as a business owner with a career that has spanned both public service and private enterprise. It is in my role as a business owner that I have been particularly interested in expanding the access and accessibility of health insurance to small business owners and to their employees. It is something I have worked on incrementally in all six terms that I've served in this House. And that is what motivates me to bring this bill to you. As I was saying, I am conscious that a good portion of this bill duplicates and in some ways competes with work that is going on the health exchange. And I am not here to debate the merits of this approach to that compared with the exchange. Should the exchange actually come all the way across from the Senate and through the House in a way that accommodates much of what small businesses need, then part of this bill would be unnecessary or even inappropriate. But there are portions of this bill that could very well be necessary and helpful even if the exchange becomes enacted into law. So I'm actually going to spend a minute or two on those portions because I think that's probably what is most important for this committee to focus on. And among those are providing access for small business owners and small business purchasers of health insurance to the state's bulk purchasing program, which would help them manage and contain the costs that their employees are paying for prescription medications. Secondly, notice requirements for changes in premiums may or may not be included in what is being done in the exchange. If it's not, then I would ask you to consider the section of this bill that provides a minimum 30-day notice for those. And finally, the section of this bill that addresses driving traffic to the state's website on the array of insurance options, including the Healthy Kids program, may be something that warrants moving forward in tandem with the exchange if it's not already part of that bill. So I'm very interested in supporting your good work on expanding access and affordability for small business owners to purchase health insurance for their employees. If that is addressed comprehensively in the exchange bill, I will applaud your efforts and support that effort. But I think there are parts of this bill that may still merit attention and support.
Questions?
Ooh, off too easy. Thank you for your attention,
well,
Mr.
I would think, I believe my co-chair and I have been deliberating in the last few minutes. We're probably going to start hearings on the exchange bill on the House side here fairly soon. So,
even without possession of the bill, I take it.
Oh, we have a bill.
Oh, I do.
So we will,
I will
there
follow
will,
that
there,
development with
so I would advise you and the committee that your suggestions might weigh into what we're going to be starting soon and take into consideration. So you can watch from the sidelines and make sure those points are included or come back to us with a why aren't they, and we'll refer you to Rocky.
Yes, Mr. King and I have already discussed this bill. I applaud your efforts. I will follow them with enthusiasm, and thanks for your time.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
And with that, I will. We have no further testimony for this bill at this time, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2918. And that will move us then back to our work sessions at the beginning, which are going to be some of the fastest work sessions we have ever done. I'll start by opening a work session on House Bill 2384, and we'll see how fast we can get through this one, Madam Assistant.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2384 had a public hearing on the 21st of February. It establishes the 9-member Dental Hygiene Committee in the Oregon Board of Dentistry. It directs the committee to make recommendations to the board on regulation of the dental hygienist and directs the board to carry out recommendations except as specified circumstances. It also specifies the duties of the committee. The bill also has an emergency clause which would be effective on passage.
Okay, because of extraordinary effort on the parts of the dental hygienist and the Board of Dentistry, they have come to an agreement on how we will proceed on this. We no longer need this bill, and the agreement has been that the Board of Dentistry will commit to having 4 meetings a year of the Dental Hygiene Committee, and we're going to see how that goes. So that ends that particular issue for the moment, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2384 and be watching carefully over the next 6 to 10 months to see how that goes. So,
Mr. Chair, could I have an opportunity to vote no then on this bill?
No.
Just to get my tally?
With that, we will close.
Record your no vote.
Yeah, we will close the work session on 2384. And I want to thank you all for your effort. Agreements are always better than statutes.
Yes, it is.
Usually. Okay, with that, we will now open a work session on House Bill 3138, which you will...
Chair, I move to adopt the dash run amendments dated 3811 to House Bill 3138.
Chair Greenleck, Co-Chair Greenleck has moved to adopt the amendments to House Bill 3138 dated 3811. Any discussion? Any objection? The amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3138 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Greenleck has moved House Bill 3138 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we can move on to a roll call.
Yep. Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Excused.
Representative Boyle?
Aye.
Representative Representative Widener?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Miller?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlich?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye. Anyone would like to carry this bill?
Why don't you carry it, Mr. Chair?
I will carry it.
Michael.
I just wanted to share it with anybody who wanted.
Okay.
Close here. We'll close the work session on 3138. Not all work sessions are going to be as fast as these two, so. Okay, we will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 348. And I believe they're here for that, right?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlich, and members of the committee. I am State Senator Diane Rosenbaum from District 21 in Southeast Portland and Milwaukee and Clackamas County, and I'm also here today as co-chair of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance. And we are here to tell you about Senate Bill 348. I am here briefly to introduce the bill, and then there are two people with me who will be much more eloquent than I can be on the topic that the bill presents. Senate Bill 348 is a centerpiece of the Women's Health and Wellness Agenda, and the goal of the bill is to shed light on a disease which is of epidemic proportions, the disease of lupus, a disease which affects 20,000 Oregonians but is not nearly as well known as many other diseases that affect fewer people. It's a disease that affects primarily women. It's a disease that is not well known and that has little treatment and can be difficult to diagnose. The bill will shed light on this issue by declaring May 10th to be Lupus Awareness Day, and that will come during the month of May, which is Women's Health Month, so it's a great time to do that. This bill passed unanimously in the Senate a couple of weeks ago, and so it's coming to you with a great deal, in fact, the highest level of bipartisan support. I'm going to rapidly turn it over to Debbie McCabe because she can talk much more eloquently than I can on this topic. But just to say that, as I said before, lupus is a debilitating disease, that 90% of its victims are women. Most are of childbearing age, so this disease affects not just these women but also Oregon families in a huge way. And I have been extremely impressed and moved by the courage and intelligence and hard work that both the people who are working on lupus awareness and lupus research have brought to this. So I just want to commend the bill to you. Think that it's an opportunity to do something, not as much as perhaps we would like in a session where our resources are very limited, but really move a long way toward public education, and I think you will be astounded when you hear some of the stories you're about to hear. So thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chairs, and I will turn it over to our other witnesses.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Debbie McCabe, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm president of Molly's Fund Fighting Lupus. Joining me today for our presentation is my daughter, Molly McCabe of Portland, who's vice president of the association, and Anita Noble of Portland, who is also a member of our board. We are testifying today in support of Senate Bill 348. Molly's Fund Fighting Lupus is a not-for-profit established 3.5 years ago. It consists of a small board of 12 people committed to educating the public and the medical community about lupus, to push for earlier life-saving diagnoses, and to spur governments and foundations to fund research for a cure. Our programs include a national referral network to medical professionals for those afflicted with lupus. We conduct support groups in person and online. We provide resources for people affected by the disease on an as-needed basis, and we are just beginning a program where we are actively advocating by helping people through filing for disability through Social Security because many of our people cannot get health care coverage. We also raise money for research and awareness building through special events and other things. Our major fundraiser the last 2 years has been a thing called Serving Up Style as part of the Fall Home and Garden Show, where we've had 10,000 people through the event, and we use that as a vehicle to tell our story about the people who are affected by these disease.
What is lupus? Lupus is an autoimmune disease. It takes on several forms that affect any part of the body, but most commonly affect the skin, joints, heart, lungs, blood, kidneys, and brain. Autoimmune diseases are characterized by a malfunction of the immune system, one in which the immune system cannot distinguish between the body's own organs and tissues and foreign matter, such as viruses. Rather than simply producing antibodies to attack antigens, the immune system creates autoantibodies that attack the body itself, inflaming the joints and the organs. With early diagnosis, living with lupus is difficult but manageable. However, diagnosing lupus is a difficult and long process. In fact, lupus is one of the few diseases that has a rising mortality rate because diagnosis comes too late. It's a disease that is not well understood by the public or the medical profession. The diagnosis of lupus is based on a combination of physical symptoms and laboratory results. Tests may take several months or, in my daughter's case, 3.5 years before diagnosis is made. Lupus can be expensive to manage and live with. A recent study showed that the average annual cost to provide health care for a person with lupus was $12,643 and was nearly $21,000 when lost productivity on the job was included. Lastly, there has not been a new drug approved by the FDA in over 50 years for this disease. However, I'm pleased to tell you that the first drug of its kind in 52 years was approved last week, and we're excited about that potential.
Who does it affect?
Could you identify yourself, please, for the record?
My name is Anita Noble from Portland, Oregon. I am a board member of Molly's Fund Fighting Lupus, and I am afflicted by lupus myself.
Thank you.
And I thank you for your time. Who does lupus affect? It affects more people than multiple sclerosis, cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy, and leukemia combined. 90% of those affected by lupus are women, and 2/3 of those diagnosed are women of color. It's difficult to diagnose lupus. What is that difficulty? The medical profession is not well trained for lupus diagnosis or treatment. It is usually diagnosed through a process of elimination. Therefore, testing is extensive and expensive. Under our current medical and insurance systems, doctors are reluctant to go through all the steps it takes to reach a diagnosis. They are penalized in some cases if they run too many tests. They are also compartmentalized by their specialty and don't look at the patient with a complex issue beyond their specialty. I can speak from experience having a pulmonologist, a rheumatologist, an ophthalmologist, not to mention my primary care, and lupus affects my lungs where I had to have lung surgery. In a span of 6 months, I've had 3 hospitalizations and ambulance trips to the ER. The patient then ends up bouncing back and forth between specialists with no one looking at the big picture and putting the pieces of the diagnosis together. There is also a misconception about women and their emotional needs that tends to be blamed for the symptoms and their presentation. Doctors' questions tend to focus on depression and psychiatric issues rather than the symptoms themselves, especially if you come back with the same symptoms over and over due to the disease. I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Molly McCabe of Portland, Oregon, and today I would like to share the words of one of my dear friends and a lupus survivor by the name of Nicole Lowry. For me, having lupus is like living a double life. On the days I can leave the house, I do my best to look like a happy, normal, pain-free person. I want to blend in, not have someone wonder why I'm limping or why my face is swollen. But at home is where living with lupus really plays out. That is where I do my best to deal with the severe fatigue, depression, and painful arthritis pain that plagues me on a regular basis. For many living with lupus means having to deal with painful swollen joints, fevers, rashes, nausea, migraines, blurry vision, fatigue, depression, anxiety, hair loss, stomach and intestinal problems. And that's just a handful of the more common symptoms of this illness. To put it simply, on a bad day, it feels like you have the flu. Your whole body aches, you're sick to your stomach, you don't have an appetite, your head is pounding, and it's difficult to see, and you have no energy to complete normal daily tasks. What's it like to be a young mother with lupus? Well, for me, it meant an emergency C-section at 7 months to save my failing kidneys and start heavy-duty treatments that my daughter Madison would not have survived. After 5 long weeks at Dornbecker Children's Hospital, my husband and I were overjoyed to bring her home, but raising a preemie with severe reflux and difficulty eating meant not sleeping for more than 2 hours at a time for over a year. This, of course, was incredibly difficult on my body and required me to redefine what motherhood means to me. Daily life was miserable, and without the endless love of my and support of my husband, John, I would not have made it through that time in our lives. And now that Madison is almost 2 years old, it means careful monitoring of everyone she comes in contact with. All of our friends and family know to cancel a date with us if they have a cold or think they might be sick. It means limited contact with her peers because the pain, swelling, and migraines that I experience regularly keep us from leaving the house. And simple tasks like dressing, walking, preparing a meal, or driving are like climbing Mount Everest for me. Playdates are a risky outing for us because I'm so highly immune suppressed that even the common cold can almost certainly mean hospitalization or an increase in medications like steroids to combat a flare. But what's the worst part about being diagnosed and learning to live with lupus? It's the realization that you won't be able to live life as you once did. It strips you of your dreams and your identity, and it reduces you to a shell of what you once were and what you could be. It's like being trapped inside a body that doesn't work the way it once did. It's going to sleep when you're 20 years old and waking up being 70. Do I share all of this because I want you to pity those you know with lupus? No, absolutely not. I share with you these intimate details so you can begin to understand what a day in our lives is like. And my hope is that you understand, then your compassion will drive you to help us spread awareness of this disease through a statewide lupus day on May 10th.
Thank you. Any questions? I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I have three friends with lupus, and it's a very difficult and unpredictable disease. And one of my concerns that I think you're addressing is too many people don't consider it to be a serious disease. It's just an aggravation. And if you know someone who has a tough round of lupus, it is very, very debilitating. I think it's a good thing that you do. Thank you.
Thank you very much for holding the hearing, and we're looking forward to a work session in the near future.
This is a very compassionate committee. You'll probably get your wish.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, members.
With that, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 348, and we will move on to a hearing on 3331.
It's up to you.
Okay. We'll open a hearing on House Bill 3331 and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3331 is at the request of Representative Widener. It requires that requires licensed health care facilities and long-term care facilities to require licensed or certified health care professionals interacting with patients or family members of the patients in those facilities to wear identification tags displaying the name and scope of practice of the medical specialty of that profession.
Representative Widener, I believe the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. I am Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, most of Yamhill County and some of Polk County, soon to change with redistricting.
Oh, yeah. So. Now looking forward to that.
Dear members of the Healthcare Committee, thank you for allowing me the time and opportunity to explain the intent and substance of House Bill 3331. House Bill 3331 came to my attention at the request of a constituent, Dr. Eric Swenson, MD, board-certified and practicing vascular surgeon, and this is the area of my testimony where my staff should be abused, because they've put McKenzie River Medical Center, and they're from Eugene, and they're ducks. Well, I'm a beaver, and it's Willamette Valley Medical Center, so if you can alert that change that should be showing up on the S-Drive soon to correct it, I would appreciate it.
Correct here.
It is correct on all of them. Oh, so you've been had, Representative.
Well, they were playing a game with me with my testimony. They were trying to get me to become a duck.
We're going to send our sympathies to your staff.
I think Representative Hoyle might have been behind that as well. So, anyway, Dr. Swenson had expressed to me that although the hospitals and clinics have rules to specify the area of practice for employees who interface with the public, sometimes lapse in the procedure and creates a confusion, especially for those who are in medical emergencies and for some senior citizens. When patients and their family members are under duress, it can be easy to become confused when dealing with so many hospital or clinic employees. The situation we are trying to avoid is when a patient is receiving instruction for medicine and post-procedure care that multiple opinions are shared with the patient from a variety of persons. The intent of this bill is to alleviate this type of confusion and circumvent future miscommunications by having each employee wear the proper identification when interacting with the patients and their families, so they can choose for themselves based upon an educated assessment whose advice to follow in case of differing opinions regarding medicines or post-procedures care practices. I've worked with the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and aid in drafting the amendment, and these organizations are in support of the bill. I also want to thank Rep. Matthews for introducing the amendment that brought the collaborative support. I appreciate your time and consideration on House Bill 3331, and we've worked hard to make sure we have everybody in support of this bill and that we are a little more clear on identifying who we are when we're approaching patients in the medical community. With that, I will take any questions.
Are there any questions for Representative Widener?
I don't have a record of the amendment.
I don't have it either.
I don't either.
I just wonder what it might be and what it does.
It is changing the identification to their title, I believe, is what it said. I actually might have it sitting up there by my computer. Okay. So, but it should be coming soon.
So it's a smaller name ID that's a little more specific and doesn't
correct.
Include scope of practice and some of these
right.
other things that would be pretty
so
hard to read.
It would just be John Smith, janitor, John Smith, nurse. So what their job title is or scope of practice is. So
I do have a question. There have been some people that have been concerned about having their last name. They're worried about a patient stalking them or something like that. Could that be, if it was individual preference, go along with simply saying Janet P. Nurse or something? I mean,
I would be fine with that.
I think that would make sense.
Because really, the biggest thing, my concern with this is, I mean, first name and initial would be fine. And then their scope of practice when they come in, because last thing we want is the janitor coming in with a stethoscope around his neck. And
or a delivery man.
Or the delivery man, correct. So,
anything else?
And most hospitals, in all honesty, are already abiding by this, and most medical facilities. It had been quite a while since I'd ran into the situation, but I actually did last Friday when I was in the immediate care, had a doctor come in who did not have any sort of ID, and I didn't know if she was the nurse or the doctor or what, and until we got into it a little further.
Leftover patient.
So.
Anything else for Rep. Widener? If you can return to your seat. And we will call Dave Fiskum and Lauren Rhodes, please.
And Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I believe you have it either on your computer or in your packet, written testimony from the Association of Hospitals and Health Systems that speak to this bill and are supportive and just provide some additional information.
Mr. Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lauren Rhodes, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association, and we represent long-term care facilities which would be impacted by this bill. I've spoken with Representative Widener and indicated that, and also on the testimony sign-up sheet today, that we're neutral on the bill considering our facilities do this, like Representative Widener referenced. It's a best practice across the spectrum to have individuals and people receiving care know who's providing that care to them, especially in a long-term care setting where cognitive impairments are commonplace. It's really important for folks to know who it is that is helping them. One interesting, when I was researching this bill, law I came across was actually ORS 441096, which was passed in 2005, requiring healthcare practitioners who work in healthcare facilities to wear identification badges. And I think this bill goes a little bit further, just more in terms of specificity, because it requires that badge to be worn when you're having face-to-face contact. So I suspect that's a little bit of a change from what is currently in statute, but I did want to bring that to your attention. And just from our perspective, there's nothing in this bill around penalties or sort of punishment or enforcement. And I'm just want to make sure that the record reflects that I'd like to know a little bit more about where that punishment, or if there were to be a punishment phase, how that would play out in terms of impact on a facility versus an individual who may forget their name tag accidentally and a surveyor comes into the building that day on an unexpected visit. So I am happy to take any questions, but just wanted to make sure that our concerns were noted. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, for the record, I did communicate with the agencies or the departments, and my intent in this bill is just when they come in and do the inspections, that say, hey, make sure you're wearing your name badge if they see somebody without a name badge, not to cause any punitive damages or hurt the healthcare professional from maybe receiving employment someplace because they got a bad mark against them, because it's hard enough to get a job in this environment that we're in now. So,
Mr. Fiskum?
Mr. Co-Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Fiskum here, with your indulgence, wearing two hats. Andy Easton would like to have been here today, but she became down ill and went home, and she asked me to pinch hit for her.
Two hats and no badges.
You don't have to have a lobbyist badge, Mr. Chair. You probably shouldn't have one. I also appear on behalf of Providence Health System. As most of you know, OHHS has submitted some written testimony to you, which I will not read, but we do support the spirit of House Bill 3331. We understand the intent as expressed by Representative Widener, and we understand that, as my colleague to my right has said, we already are under a state law, ORS 441069, that requires practitioners to wear name badges, and for healthcare facilities to develop policies that specify the size and content of the ID badge. That would usually include titles, nurse, physician, volunteer. There are some challenges here, I think, just on their practical level. In some cases, Providence Health System employees may have a number of titles and may have more than one scope of practice. It'd be challenging to fit all kinds of information on one name badge. We suspect you'll understand that. It's also a challenge to think about the phrase scope of practice and what that really means. How detailed does that need to be for the limited size of a badge? We would hope not to have to replace, for instance, in Providence hospitals around the state, all of our current badges, which we think comply with the spirit of this law. We're pleased to sit down with Representative Widener, and he's right in characterizing the hospital association as being in support of the spirit of this legislation. And as well, Representative and Chairs, if there is an amendment, we'd be pleased to look at that, and that may address some of our concerns, which we wanted to put on the record today. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It might be a question for Representative Weiner. I wonder why LC drafted this the way they did rather than as an amendment to 441.096, because I pulled that up, and it, as they've characterized it, it reads, a healthcare practitioner working at a healthcare facility and providing direct care to a patient shall wear an identification badge indicating the practitioner's name and professional title. We may be trying to do a little bit more with this, which I appreciate, but I wonder why that wasn't done as an amendment to this underlying ORS.
Well, I'm trying to get my staff that's not responding to text messages right now to bring down the actual amendment, because it's basically would be job title at the facility, or actually I think I have some help grabbing that, so because we've clarified that, because that was the issue that we ran into and that I worked on with Representative Matthews. So.
Am I correct to assume we're going to get a cleaned up amendment that reflects this hearing or concerns? Or
yeah, it's done. Most people have seen it. I will get it here before this committee's over. Somebody just walked out the door and headed up to grab it so everybody can see it, but it's not out of LC yet. So
we're not working it today. I would assume that when we come back into a work session, all the interested parties will have taken part in that, and we will have coming to us whatever the amendment is supposed to say. Understood?
Mr. Co-Chair, just one quick clarification. I think the document from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems says ORS 441069. That's transposed. It should be 096, as Representative Cannon pointed out. So just for the record, that's a correction to our testimony. Thank you very much.
Not a problem. Okay, and then I will assume then that we'll have the corrections as noted forthcoming, and we will close the hearing on House Bill 3331 for now. And we will move to House Bill 2908, which I believe is the other end of the dais.
That's right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2908 is at the request of Representative Doherty. The bill prohibits a person from performing a pelvic exam on an anesthetized or unconscious woman unless the woman is given informed consent to the examination or the examination is necessary for diagnostic purposes. It creates a Class A misdemeanor, which is punishable by 1 year imprisonment, $6,250 fine, or both. And you should have either in your packet or on your computer a dash one amendment that Representative Doherty will be speaking to as well.
Thank you very much. This seems to be committee day, but co-chair Thompson, co-chair Greenlick, and the rest of my committee. My name is Margaret Doherty. I'm the representative for House District 35 in Greater Tigard. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today regarding House Bill 2908. The use of female patients who are anesthetized as a method for medical students to practice pelvic exams is not a new phenomenon. One study found that in 1983, 23% of U.S. and Canadian schools surveyed reporting using this method with patients, anesthetized patients to teach pelvic exams. In 1990, this had grown to 37.3%. These figures demonstrate the clear need to balance the need for adequate opportunities for medical students and the rights of patients. While this balance is managed appropriately in most cases, there is still a benefit to explicitly prohibit the violation of patient rights in this situation. Before going any further, I want to assure the committee that I have spoken with representatives from our hospitals and healthcare institutions in Oregon, and this is not currently common practice in Oregon. But having said that, this bill may appear to be an answer without a problem. But when the bill, a concept, was first presented to me, I did some background research and looked into the issue, and I found cases of hospitals and educators defending this practice. In an article in 2005 in the Journal of Healthcare Law and Policy, one account was particularly disturbing, and I quote, A student in a 1996 narrative published by a Duke University professor described five or six students doing successive pelvic exams on the same woman. It was like all the medical students parading in to each take their own turn, you know, like going to a vending machine and walking by. Only it's not a vending machine, it's a woman's vagina, and they're each taking your turn. As previously stated, this is not a common practice in Oregon, but there is currently no prohibition. This bill would make it obvious that this practice is unacceptable in our state, providing repercussions for violations. In front of you, you have a Dash 1 amendment that we worked with our the stakeholders in this that you have in front of you that addresses a concern that have come up as we've talked to folks about the bill. And this amendment, one, narrows the scope of the bill to apply only within a medical setting. The second thing it does is grants additional exemptions for, one, a court order to collect evidence, two, for treatment purposes, and three, for a designee to grant consent. The last thing it does is it shifts discipline to the appropriate licensing board rather than through a criminal process. There still may be some concerns among relevant stakeholders not yet reflected in the Dash 1 amendments, and I'm committed to work with them to ensure that the development of the amendment will address any of the remaining concerns. I thank you for your time and consideration of House Bill 2908, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Greenlick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill. I think it's an important bill. Do you know where the same practice is used to train students to do rectal exams for prostates and men?
I did not research that.
Because it would be, I think, an interesting opportunity to do the same thing. And I, for one, would rather have them practice on me when I'm unconscious. Right?
Chair Greenlick, Chair Thompson, and the rest of the committee, I think that is probably the wish of most men.
Not all. Could I? Could I ask you about item C? One of the concerns that I had, and I think you and I have talked about it, is that if an unconscious rape victim came in, they would be unable to do a rape kit for that. Would it be my understanding it would require a court order to do that rape kit?
Yes. What we did is we did talk to law enforcement, the district attorneys, and that's why we had the Dash 1 amendment. And what they were saying is a court order can come very quickly. Sure. And it's one of these situations that there may be a woman that has been brought in from sexual trauma that might be out for an hour or so, and that would be fine for the evidence. It's the ones that are longer than that. And in that time, they assured us that a court order, they would have time for a court order.
Great. Mr. Chair, I hope we work this bill as fast as we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as I think about it, I'm surprised this isn't covered by statutes under informed consent. Yeah. I mean, you know, and maybe hospitals or surgeons write in special provisions for teaching experiences or something, but I mean, to me, I'm rather incredulous that they can perform a procedure that's not related to what the consented procedure is. I just can't imagine this is not covered under some other statute. And don't misunderstand. I mean, this is clearly wrong, and frankly, I don't want them doing procedures on men or women of any type without permission and authorization or going through an appropriate channel. I mean, I understand emergencies occur and this and that, but to have protocols where people's are subjected to things without their knowledge and consent, without careful review, is absolutely unforgivable, and I believe illegal in this state already.
Well,
I wonder if we could have counsels.
I imagine it could be included under battery, which I think it probably would be, but that's a complex
could
matter.
Be a criminal even.
And we could have that looked into, as I say.
I just wonder if it wouldn't do well to look a little bit or tie it to some other pieces. I can't imagine, I don't know.
Well,
you haven't been involved in that
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, Representative Kennemer. There are in other states that have laws to this. There are in teaching situations in medical schools. There is consent.
Yeah.
And there are women that would consent to this when they're anesthetized. And that's not the issue. The issue is through our investigation, there is no statute in Oregon that requires consent.
Specifically does it, but I bet other statutes do it. At least I hope so. And maybe we could check that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have to admit, at my age, I didn't think I could be surprised a whole lot, but this did surprise me that the situation existed because everybody is so careful about male-female examinations and all that thing sort of stuff anymore. I'm really surprised that this hasn't been covered, but it's something that obviously needs to be. So I think it would suffice that we ask our committee help here to ask LC to double-check and make sure this isn't covered in other statute. But my guess is you're right. It's not. So we will do that before we proceed, but
probably
not. Okay.
And one other thing I would like to say is we have to talk to our teaching hospitals, and we are convinced that this is not a practice that they have. But again, it's one of those things that let's not open any doors.
We'll
make sure it is not a practice. But we're very comfortable with our teaching hospitals. They're first rate.
Any other questions for Representative Daugherty before we ask her to return?
Okay.
You're off the hook.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And while you're returning, we'll call Christine Ehrman. You would identify yourself for the record first and begin.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Greenlick and Thompson. My name is Christine Ehrman. I'm the Executive Director of the Sexual Assault Task Force. We're a 501c3 private nonprofit statewide organization providing training and technical assistance to responders and for persons working for the prevention of sexual violence. And I just wanted to thank Representative Daugherty for bringing this bill. I agree with the committee members who have expressed seemed incredulous at the fact that this doesn't already have some sort of a statute that would prohibit this type of behavior. My understanding is that this was pretty common practice in teaching hospitals for quite some time until relatively recently, much more recently than I think any of us would be comfortable with. And I am pleased to agree with Representative Daugherty that we haven't heard that this is a current problem in Oregon. However, I agree with Representative Daugherty, too, that this is something that does need to be prohibited just in case that there is any question about it again. I appreciate the -1 amendments. We at the Sexual Assault Task Force work very hard to encourage medical providers to make every opportunity to collect forensic evidence in sexual assault cases whenever possible and when consent is there. However, no forensic evidence would be more important than a woman's autonomy. And so for that reason, I requested that Representative Daugherty include the court order language, meaning that it would take more than simply saying this should be done. It would take a third party hearing the arguments of the investigators and possibly medical providers before that evidence is collected without consent. And thankfully, that also is a very rare event where the victim would present in a case where she's not expected to regain consciousness for a while. I did want to address the issue of the criminal sanction of assault, or what would perhaps be considered assault. In Oregon, the crime of assault requires that there be some pain, and a pelvic exam may well not incur any pain on the victim. And so a criminal sanction of assault may not be possible. That being said, I do think it's appropriate that the -1 amendments recognize that this is a disciplinary action that should be taken by the licensing board rather than perhaps a criminal case. There are all kinds of issues that would come into a criminal decision. And so I think that that might be one of the reasons that it was taken away from the criminal sanction. I don't believe I have any other points, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
Thank you all very much.
Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2908. And is there anything else we need to cover? I think we're okay.
Do you have anything, Mr. Kosher?
No, I don't.
Okay.
And with that, we will close the House Health Committee for Friday, March 18th, 2011. And I expect that we'll have to work.